of our adult classes as well as the teen classes are meeting here in the auditorium this morning. If you were not here at early service, then you'll want to be introduced to Dan Cooper. Dan is here to begin our evangelism workshop with us. It begins today, runs through Monday night and Tuesday night. And we have already had our first installment, been challenged as we've looked at Zacchaeus. Some of you will hear about that during second service. During our class time, Dan's going to be moving rather rapidly through some material, answering the question, just what is friendship evangelism? Dan is from Pittman, New Jersey. He has been preaching there for 25 years, and that congregation has grown. In fact, is that the largest church in that part of the country up there?
In the Philadelphia area it is.
In the Philadelphia area, a 300-member congregation. If any of you have traveled up in that part of the world, or especially on up in New England, you know that there are not many congregations of that size. Dan has really developed a passion through the years for evangelism, and is here to help us draw on that very same passion, learn how to be more evangelistic people. So, Dan, we're excited about that. Turn it over to you.
All righty. Thank you, Joe. Do we have any more of those study guides, or are they pretty well gone? Some of us are. If you're going to be here for the whole seminar tonight, or the second service, I should say, first, and then tonight, and then Monday and Tuesday night, we have study guides. They look like this. And you're going to want to have one, and you're going to want to bring it with you every time you come back here. Don't just remember your ice cream tonight. Bring your booklet, too, okay? And some of our good brothers will be passing those out. You know, can we go ahead and just go to the next slide, or maybe it's the next one? We're going to start with kind of some fun things right up front here. There you go. We're going to... Thank you, teens, for sitting down here. This makes me happy. Makes your parents happy. If you misbehave, they'll do what my parents used to do to me, which was flick me on the back of the ear. No, they won't do that. Anybody else have parents who flicked you in the back of the ear when you were misbehaving? Church was different in those days. We're going to talk about evangelism. I just want to share some of my thoughts about evangelism. And while this is called the Bible class hour, those of you who are here that during first service really got the biblical background for what we're talking about today. And if you weren't here for first service, you'll get it in second service. This is just kind of going to be a real pragmatic, nuts and bolts look at what is friendship evangelism. Friendship evangelism is sometimes called lifestyle evangelism. Other times I've heard it called everyday evangelism. But it's just kind of the way that we approach life, seeing every person that we meet, every person that we see, whether we know them or not, as one of God's creation who needs to be headed to heaven. And it's our task, since we've already come to understand who Jesus is and what he wants for our lives, it's our task to do more than get ourselves to heaven. I have a personal obligation, I believe, and so do every one of you, if you are Christians, not just to get to heaven, not just to get your family to heaven, but to take other people along with you on the way. And so we're going to be talking about a very practical way that you can do that. And I need to also say, since about the mid-1980s, churches of Christ as a whole have not been doing a good job of sharing their faith. We just haven't. We've kind of become root-bound. We have generally turned inward. And so today, many churches of Christ are either plateaued or declining. And I don't want to be the bearer of bad news. I just want to tell it the way it is. And it doesn't have to be that way. And so one of my passions is helping churches to rekindle that evangelistic fervor that we once had when I was growing up. The brothers with the study guides are here now, so if you would like one of those, if you are committed to being here, second service, and then tonight, Monday night, and Tuesday night, you just hold up your hand, and we'll be sure that you get one of these. Now, some of our intelligent, good-looking young people on the front pews are going to tell us how many squares they can find. There's a smart man. How many squares the rest of you find? 16, 25, 26, 29, Okay. What's the purpose? Dan, we're supposed to be in Bible class, not some geometry lesson, right? Okay. The purpose of this simple, silly illustration is to illustrate that what you first see when you first look may not be all that there is to see. Now, all of us, when we first look up there, we all see 16 squares. Am I right? You all see 16 squares. Okay. Hold your hand up. Keep holding your hand up if you want one of these study guides. And I hope you'll follow along with us. But I'm going to tell you, this young man, what is your name?
Graham.
Graham?
Yeah.
Graham's parents, you ought to be proud. He was the first one with the right answer. 30 squares. That's how many there are. And you say, well, I don't see 30 squares. Let me show them to you if we can get this coordinated with our PowerPoint guys. You see the first 16? There's 17, 18, 19, 20 next. 21, 22. The squares of 4. 23, 24. And then one right in the middle is 25. So there's the 25 squares. But then it gets bigger than that. There's 26 blocks of 9. And 27. And 28. And 29. And finally, there's that last big square of 30. Okay. And you say, Dan, I don't get it. And I'm saying to you, well, that's to illustrate an important point about the Bible. Even though you may have looked at it, you may have read it for years, many times, if you will dig deeper, or maybe even if you will have someone else that has read it from a different perspective, share with you what they've seen, you can see things that have been there all along, but you just never saw them. And that's what this lesson is about today. If we could go to the next slide. Most of us in this room remember that we were saying in the churches of Christ in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, we were the fastest growing religious group in America. That's what we said. And we believe that to be true. And we even believe that along 1980 or 85, our membership topped out at right at 3 million people. That was our wish. That was our belief. One of the problems is, since the churches of Christ are not a denomination, we never really did have an accurate way of keeping track of how many members we had. And so different well-intentioned preachers and college professors and college presidents and publishers of our brotherhood bookstores, they would guess how quickly the church was growing. And so nobody was intentionally deceiving anyone. I'm not making any accusations. What I am saying is, since we're not a denomination, it's just really, really hard to track that. The reality is, we were never, I do not believe, about 3 million in the churches of Christ. Rather, if we could look at the next slide, the reality is that we were about 1.2 million membership in the churches of Christ, mainline churches of Christ in America. Okay? And that peaked about 1985. And I met with some of your leadership people last night, and many of them had already been reading what the Christian Chronicle has been revealing over the last year or so as they have studied what's happening with churches in America. And churches of Christ, the number of churches in America is decreasing. I'm talking about churches of Christ. And the number of members of the churches of Christ in America is decreasing. Not dramatically, but by about 1% over the last 10 to 20 years, membership, the most optimistic hope, the most optimistic word is that we are plateaued, that we are level. But most are now saying, because we have become more scientific, more exacting in the way that we can calculate how many churches there are and how many members there are, is we're saying probably about 1.2, maybe 1.25 million members of the church in America today. But since 1985, we haven't done much, you know. But that's of concern to me. The gospel hasn't changed. The Great Commission hasn't changed. Our orders to follow the scriptures haven't changed, but somehow we just aren't getting the job done like we once did. Let's go to the next slide. I want to share just with you some what I call random thoughts on evangelism. Number one random thought is both Christians and non-Christians are uptight about evangelism. Could we go to the next one? I am supposedly an authority. I supposedly know about how to do evangelism, how to share faith effectively. But I'll just go ahead and admit to you right up front, when I sit down to start engaging a person in a Bible study, I get a little bit anxious. I get a little bit uptight. Like, what if I say the wrong thing? You know, there's a heavy duty on me. Because whatever I teach, if I'm not teaching the truth, I'm going to stand in judgment for what I've taught. And so I get a little bit uptight, and I am supposedly an authority. And if I do, I can only imagine what everyday Christian feels when he or she sits down to engage a person in a spiritual discussion. It's like, am I going to lose a friend here? Am I going to get it right? Am I going to remember what I'm supposed to be saying? So Christians get uptight about evangelism. But let me tell you what. If we get uptight about evangelism, the non-Christian gets uptight about evangelism, because what they pretty quickly deduce is what we are suggesting to them is, I'm okay and you're not okay. I'm okay, I've got this spiritual stuff figured out, and you don't have it figured out, so I'm going to enlighten you, and in the process of enlightening you, I'm going to try to change the way you think, and I'm going to change the way you believe, and I'm going to even maybe change whether or not you go to church, or if you go to church, what church you go to. So do you think that makes people uptight? Oh yeah, that makes people uptight. Anybody here love to change, just can't wait to make a change? I don't like changing. And people in the religious world, or people that are searching for answers, they don't like to change. And so we need to be very careful about the way we address this, and we need to be very careful about our own attitude, that we not have a holier-than-thou, self-righteous, arrogant attitude, so that we come across in that way, because people don't like it when we come across that way, and that's one of the tendencies that religious people everywhere have, to come across as having it all figured out. I know what you don't know, and I'm going to set you straight. If we could look at the next slide. We have three general approaches to evangelism that we have used in our fellowship that I know of. And I'm not saying any of them are good or bad. I'm just saying there are three approaches. Number one approach is what I call mass media. Mass media evangelism, if we could go to the next slide, or there you go. Mass media evangelism is what we do when we do a newspaper ad campaign, or what we did for years and years as we sponsored Herald of Truth, either radio or program. The mass media is effective in that it gets the message of Jesus out to hundreds, thousands, maybe even millions of people with one message. I'm not against it. All I'm saying is, it's very impersonal, and it costs a lot of money. And most of us in this room will never be personally involved teaching on the radio, writing a newspaper article. We may financially support them, but we won't be directly personally involved. But it is one way that works very effectively. I heard last night that some of you do World Bible School. That's a form of mass media. You know, we send the Bible school lessons out to hundreds, thousands of people. But then that leads us to the next step of evangelism, is what I call personal touch evangelism. Personal touch evangelism is what happens when I follow up on mass media, when somebody... Okay, here we go. Personal touch evangelism is what I did for 4 years I was in college. Every summer we'd go on Campaigns Northeast, knocking on people's doors. Hello, my name is Dan. This is my wife, Catherine. Total strangers, cold turkey. We'd like to come and study the Bible with you, or we'd like to invite you to some special meetings that we're having at the church. Personal touch is communicating to a lot of people, but in as personal of a way as we know how to do it. And I'm not against personal touch evangelism. Some of you may have been door-knocking campaigns, or you may have set up a booth at a fair or in a mall where you're talking just kind of cold turkey with people, so that you do have a smile, you do have a handshake, you do have eye-to-eye contact, but you're still really talking to non-people that you don't know. Could I just ask, and I don't want to embarrass anybody, how many of you have ever been involved in personal touch evangelism, like a door-knocking campaign, a booth at a fair, a booth at a mall? Hold up your hands. Okay. Maybe over half of us. Okay, so that's a second form of evangelism. There's mass media, number one, personal touch, and leads to what I'm talking about this whole seminar, and I'm not against either one of those first two, but what I'm talking about during this seminar is something that every single one of you can, and I believe biblically should be doing. It's what I call friendship evangelism. That is to say, I'm going to share the message of Jesus with people that I already know. Relatives, friends, co-workers, neighbors. Friendship evangelism is based upon the premise that you're most likely to be most credible, not with strangers, but with people you already know. In fact, what happens when somebody comes and knocks on your door? And you don't have to answer out loud. I'll just go ahead and confess what I do. before I even see them coming, or as I see them coming, I think, oh, brother, here comes an interruption in my time at home. They're going to be selling Girl Scout cookies or some kind of stuff, or they're going to be some religious fanatic that I don't want to be bothered by. And so, can I just tell you, they're a nuisance? I don't know if people, if that's because I'm from the Northeast, but does anybody here just look forward to strangers knocking on your door? You know, no. And so, friendship evangelism says I'm most likely to be most effective if I know the people that I'm trying to share with. If I already have rapport with them, if I already have some kind of credibility with them. So that leads to point number one, and we're going to have to rush, and I already will tell you we're not going to get through all of this, but we're going to go as far as we can, and then we'll wrap it up here later. Did you take my book? I left my book somewhere. Oh, well, okay. Oh, here it is. Okay. You guys, all of you guys here, you need to kind of follow along. I know these books are very expensive and very difficult to keep up with, but I want you to keep up. Number one point, people do not really care how much you know until they know how much you care. I know a preacher who can quote the entire Gospel of Matthew verbatim. You heard me right. I said it right. Matthew 1 to Matthew 28, he can quote, he knows a lot. Does that mean he's a good evangelist, yes or no? No. No. People aren't impressed if you can quote a lot of Bible. You know what impresses people? When your knowledge of the Bible impacts you and the way you treat them. So I'm suggesting to you, we are people of the book. We have prided ourselves in being people of the book, and that's a good thing. We need to have high regard for God's Word. We need to know the Word. And I challenge every 5 years, our whole church is challenged to read through the whole Bible because I want us to be a people of the book, a people who know the book, a people who believe in the book and who trust it as God's inspired Word. But knowing the book and even knowing it well does not mean that you're going to be effective as a soul winner. Because people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care about them. So, true story. This is a story that I tell in my video, but I want to tell even more of it right now. January the 8th, 1975, big woman expecting her second child, a lab worker, x-ray technician more precisely, goes into premature labor. She goes into shock. She is not a churchgoer, but she lives just down the road from our church building. Every day, day after day, for weeks and weeks and months, she has seen the sign out front of the building that says, Christians meet here. The Church of Christ invites you to attend one of these services. Then it had our scheduled services. Yvonne is her name, is now in the fight for her life. She knows that she has gone into shock. She knows that she's lost extensive amounts of blood. Those of you who have a medical background, placenta previa is what was happening to Yvonne. She was delivering the placenta before the baby. She knew that her baby might be brain damaged, and so as she is laying in the OR, she says to God, God, if you get me through this, and if you get my baby through this, and we're okay, I'm going to make my life right with you. January the 8th, 1975. 3 months later, for the first time, she walks into the doors of our church building. Yvonne, her 3-year-old son, carrying this little baby that has just been born. She tells that story. I am here because I made a promise to God 3 months ago. When Aaron was born, his face was blue. He was deprived of oxygen for we don't know how long, but he was alive. And so Yvonne was making good on this promise that she made. Catherine and I, my wife is Catherine, we said, well, can we stop and see you after that very first Sunday she walked in? She was scared. By the way, always visitors are scared. They don't know what they're going to find when they walk in here. They don't know what kind of service they had. She was scared. She was even more scared because she hadn't been to church anywhere of any kind for years and years and years, and she was married to a Jewish guy. And she said, what kind of a reception, if I do like this church, am I going to find when they find out I'm married to a Jew? So we set up Bible studies. We set up visits. Hey, look, one of the things I do, I'm full-time. I like to get together and study the Bible with people. So she said, okay. We set up an appointment. We go into her home. We hear more details about the story of her nearly dying, about the fact that she's married to a Jewish guy. She's here with his permission, but not with his blessing. Okay, well, you can go, but I'm not very excited about it because I liked our life the way it was pretty well already. After 3 months of study, Yvonne decides it's time for her to make her commitment. She is baptized into Christ. Several months later, her Jewish husband, Harold, decides he needs to check out this church that his wife is loving so much. So Harold starts coming. He sits right up here on the right, about three or four pews back with his wife. He's inquisitive. He was bar mitzvahed when he was 12 and was raised in a conservative synagogue, but has become pretty inactive. My first visit to Harold, I discover he's bought one of these handyman special houses. He bought the house with the upstairs finished, the split level, and the downstairs not finished. And I'd never met a Jew before. Never met a Jew. So I didn't know where to start. I said, Harold, my name is Dan. I'm the preacher at the church where your wife has been going. And just wanted to get to know you better. Thanks for coming to church. He said, well, I'm curious. I want to check out what my wife has gotten involved in. You know, I don't want her to be involved in some cult. In New Jersey, I don't know which is better, having no reputation or having the reputation that some churches in group that his wife was getting involved with. So I said, well, look, I just want to get to know you better. If we can study the Bible, great. I said, what are you doing downstairs? He said, I'm doing drop ceiling. We bought this house. It was a handyman special. The contractor finished the upstairs, but I've got to finish the downstairs. And so he said, have you ever done drop ceiling? I said, no, but I would like to learn. So he helped me learn how to do drop ceiling, and I helped him learn about who Jesus was and about how to live in a way that Jesus would have a person to live, and furthermore, about how Jesus fulfilled his Old Testament Jewish prophecies of the coming Messiah. So it took about 6 months. But then on that Sunday that Harold first time came forward. Okay, I got a dead battery, I think. Yeah, so okay, here we go. I don't get to dance around as much here. Okay, so Harold said, as he responded to the invitation, he said, I don't even know why I'm here, except I'm very confused. And I'm wanting to find some answers. My wife has found something that is very exciting to her. And I want you to pray for me. Well, having been raised in the church, my daddy was a preacher. I knew how to do three things when people responded to the invitation. If they needed to place membership, I knew how to handle that. If they wanted to ask for prayers, I knew how to handle that. If they wanted to be baptized, I knew how to handle that. But I'd never had a Jew come to the invitation and say, will you pray for me? Is that okay to pray for a Jew? I said, okay, we'll pray for you. Never done it before, but I'm going to do it right now. So while my prayer, I still remember to this day, it was like, God, here is a young man that is confused and is searching for answers, and would you just use us, use his wife, use whatever means you can to help him find the answers that he's looking for in his life. June 8th, Harold came a second time, and he said, I want to be baptized. Yeah, we'd had a few Bible studies, but you know what it mostly was? It was just mostly getting to know Harold and Yvonne Pearl. Seeing who they were, being in their home, having them in our home, and just being real people, just living Christ in front of them. This time, as Harold responded, I welcomed him to the front. I announced to the church that he was wanting to be baptized, and I asked him if he would make that great confession, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. You do that here, right? Something like that. Yeah, okay, I want to be sure you're sound. Okay. And he stood up before the crowd and said, I do believe that Jesus is the Christ, God's Messiah. I still get chill bumps when I hear him. Here's a Jewish guy confessing Jesus is the Messiah. Isn't that what we're about? Yes, he is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. Yes, he is the one that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses, and all David, all those others looked forward to. And here's this Jewish guy confessing Christ is the Messiah. Why? Because I wowed him with all of my knowledge of Scripture? Because I convinced him point by point of every single prophecy that Jesus Christ fulfilled, I just have to tell you, while that is important, that's not the reason. The reason is because he saw Dan and Catherine Cooper and others in the church genuinely cared about him and them. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so one of the things, church, that we've got to do if we're going to be effective in outreach is we've got to be a caring, loving people. And after all, doesn't that kind of make sense when you put what Jesus said in John 13 together with what we're saying right now? Jesus said, "By this will all men know that you're my disciples, that you practice baptism by immersion, that you take Lord's Supper every Sunday, that you do not use instrumental music." No. I believe our position on all those issues is right, but Jesus said the way that the world is supposed to know that you're my disciples is because you love each other. It's the greatest commandment. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second greatest is love your neighbors yourself. Wow. 12 observations. Number one, people do not care how much you know until they know how much you care. Guess what? Even if we were to convince all of this community that this is the church that teaches all the truth, only the truth, and we have got it all right, mark my word, people will not come running into your doors and crashing them down. They won't. Our claim on the truth, our belief that we are teaching the truth as nearly as anyone else, as closely as we can, has not caused us to grow over the last 25 years. What causes churches to grow is when our understanding of truth so impacts the way we treat other people that they are drawn to that. Jesus says, "If I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me." How do we lift up Jesus? By living that pure, uncontaminated, unpolluted life and by loving like Jesus loved. That's how. Amen. That's the way it is. I don't have an axe to grind. I'm just saying we're not getting it right, brothers and sisters. We're not getting it right in our fellowship for some reason. Number two, our Lord was a master in the use of friendship evangelism. We should look to him as an example. That's number two. Next slide. There you go. Jesus was a master. By the way, Jesus could do all three of those forms of evangelism. He could do mass media. He'd go by the boat. He'd push out from the shore a little bit. And we're going to talk about Jesus as a fisher of men later. And he could communicate to the whole multitude on the shore. Jesus could go to the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus could preach to a mountain full of people. Jesus could do friendship evangelism. He could engage people in personal touch evangelism, just kind of one-on-one. That's kind of the way he started with Zacchaeus. It was a personal touch. He said, "Zacchaeus, you come down from that house. You're a stranger. I don't know you, cold turkey, but I'm going into your house." And you know the rest of that story. Before that story is done in Luke chapter 19, verse 10, Jesus says, "Salvation has come to this house, for he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost." Our Lord was a master in the use of friendship evangelism. Number three, and this is where we're going to get stuck. I'll just tell you, you thought we were already stuck. We weren't stuck. Now we're stuck. All reliable surveys on church growth that have been done for the last 30, 40 years indicate that people are won not through mass media, but through the influence of one or more friends. If you want to help a church grow, you don't need to build a new building. You don't need to hire some dynamic, fiery preacher. You don't need to try some new gimmick. You know what you need to do? You need to convince the people in the pew, those of you that are listening to me right now, the young people, the middle-aged people, and all of us grayheads, that I can have an impact upon other people and the way they live their lives and whether or not they spend eternity with Jesus. That's the way you do it. People are not won through mass media. People are won through to Christ through the influence of one or more friends. You say to me, "Dan, prove it." Okay, I'll prove it. Survey was done of 22,000 church members. This is the next one. And they were asked, "How was it that you chose this church to be a member?" I need to clarify, because I'm all about validation. I'm all about documentation. These were not members of the churches of Christ. They were members of conservative, Bible-believing churches, which is basically the kind of people that we're going to be appealing to. And they were asked, "How is it that you chose this church to become a member, and why did you stay once you visited for the first time?" The statistics are rather revealing. 2-3% said they walked in, they liked what they saw, they kept coming to this church. It was a good location.
By the way, I love your location. By the way, you've got a beautiful building. I'm a little bit jealous. I just will go ahead and admit to you, it's a sin I have of jealousy of pretty church buildings, but I'm a little bit jealous. But how many people just walked in, liked what they saw, kept coming, 2-3%? What about a special program? Maybe they had a seminar on marriage. Maybe they had a seminar on financial management. Maybe they had something to help with how to be a good parent or a good grandparent. 2-3% of these 22,000 said, I am a member of this church because of a special program that they had. I came, I liked it, and I kept coming. You ready for the next one? How about the preacher? This preacher is just the greatest thing going. He's got a voice like Billy Graham. He preaches, he entertains, he preaches the word. I'm sorry to say, and I believe this is wrong, just very honestly. I don't like this. 5-6% said, I'm a member of that church because of the preacher. I really do, Joe. I think we're more important than that. But I'm trying to be honest. And Dwight, I think I do. But that's what the survey said, so I'm trying to be honest. What about a time of special need? You know, Grandma was dying and the church was there. They brought meals. They mowed our yard. There was a special need that I had. And when that happened, I was attracted to that church, kept coming, became a member. 1-2%. Said, I'm a member of that church because of a special need. How about a visitation program? You know, one of these formal visitation programs that meet every Monday night or every Tuesday night, a bunch of people get together, go out and visit the visitors, go out and visit new people that have just moved in. The survey said 1-2% of the people that came to church and became members were reached through these formal visitation programs. I'm not against them, and if you're doing one, keep doing it. I'm just saying what the survey revealed was only 1-2%. How about Sunday school program? That church, I started going to that church because I wanted my kids to have a Sunday school program that taught them morals, that taught them basic principles of life. And the survey said 4-5%. By the way, spend lots of money on your vacation Bible school, on your regular Sunday school program. We need to be doing quality work in our kids' Sunday morning and Wednesday night classes. Amen? It's important. They need to have the same kind of quality or better in church that they're getting in school. Teachers need to be prepared. They need to be equipped. It's important. Parents a lot of times care more about their kids and their spiritual nourishment than they do themselves. And so we need to give them the very best that we have to offer. Crusades, revival. Anyway, Sunday school, 4-5%. Crusades, revivals. Again, I told you this wasn't done in our fellowship. We don't call them crusades and revivals in America. Now, if you go to Central America, Churches of Christ call their gospel meetings crusades and revivals. We would typically call these campaigns and gospel meetings. How many people became members of this church or of their church because of a crusade, revival, campaign, gospel meeting? 0.5%, according to the survey. Well, what does that leave us? How many of those people said, I am a member of the church today because of the influence of a friend or a relative? 75-90%. Wow. You say, Dan, I don't like that. I think you're fudging. Okay, we're going to do the little survey right here, right now, with you. Two rules. Some preachers like rules. Anytime you do a survey, you got to follow the rules. Two rules. Number one, you got to tell the truth. Okay? Number two, you can only vote once. Okay? It's kind of democratic here. You got to tell the truth, and you can only vote once. So we're going to do that survey. If you are a member of this church or whatever church you became a member, you're going to vote once, and you're going to tell the truth. How many of you walked in, liked what you saw? And I am really interested in you telling the truth, okay? You walked in, liked what you saw, kept coming, and you're a member of that church today because of that. Hold up your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Perfect. 11. Good. Will somebody write these down? Write these down for me at this church, okay? Walked in, liked what you saw. How many of you, there was some program that the church had? Maybe it was a vacation Bible school program, maybe it was a marriage enrichment program, some kind of a program that the church was sponsoring. You went to the program, you liked it, and you kept coming. How many of you are members of the church today because of a program that the church sponsored? That's a big goose egg. Zero. Okay? The preacher. Just go ahead and, confess it. I'm a part of this church because of the influence of one dynamic, outstanding, great, wonderful preacher. Please. 1, 2, 3. You know who usually holds up their hands? Here's the preacher's kids. That's who usually. Okay, we got 3 there. I'm not sure that they were all telling the truth. But anyway, What about a time of special need? You know, you were going through a really hard time, or somebody in your family was, and a special need, and the church was there, and you say, I'm a member of that church because of the way they reached out and touched special needs. Anybody? Special needs? One. What about a formal visitation program? How many of you are members of the church because of some kind of a visitation program that the church or you were going to there sponsored? They came and visited you. Visitation program? One, two. Good. Three. Okay. How about the Sunday school program? You were a member of the church because you wanted your kids to get involved in a Sunday school program where they could teach and learn some principles. Or maybe you were that kid that got involved because your parents took you. A Sunday school program. One. One. Two. Okay. Two. How about a crusade revival campaign gospel meeting? If you had to point to the reason that you were a Christian, it would be the result of a campaign gospel meeting crusade revival. How many of you here? Zero. How many of us are members of the Lord's church today because of the influence of a friend or a relative? Hold up your hand. Don't count them. But you can turn around and look back. Hold up your hand one more time. Okay. Here's the point. Whatever it was that was effective in reaching out to you and ministering to you and leading the church, does it not stand to reason that that's the most effective way to reach out and touch others? I mean, it's just common sense. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. And so it's my personal conviction that the problem with churches in America today, churches of Christ in particular, that are not growing, is that we aren't sharing our faith like we once did. We are not passionate like we once were. We're not doing for others what others did for us. And inevitably, somewhere we'll ask the question, well, what about how many of you were members' kids and so you were raised in the church? And that's a relevant question, and I'm not dodging that question. What I am saying is we're losing between 60 and 80% of our kids even then. Kids that were reared in the church, by the time they finish college or by the time they're 21, we've lost half of them at least. And maybe some estimates go as high as 80%. So even if you were raised in the church, I'm going to count you as being a Christian because of the influence of a friend or a relative, even though that is prone to kind of warp this number a bit, and I know that. Maybe the most important or the most significant thing that I will say today, this morning, is what you have just said by raising your hand when you raised it. Church, if our churches are going to grow, it's not going to be because you get a new preacher, because you build a new building, because you have some slick, sophisticated outreach method. It's going to be because you people in the pew get serious about being passionate about sharing your faith. That's it. It's very convicting. It's very humbling, the influence that we can have. The sad truth is that the longer a person has been a Christian, the less likely they are to share their faith with a non-Christian. Let me say it another way. Most people that lead another person to Christ do so the first 2 years that they are a Christian. So if you've been a Christian for 2 years or less, you're much more likely to be effective in reaching out to a non-Christian than somebody that's been a Christian 20 or 30 or 40 years. You say, why is that? Well, it ought not to be that way, because the baby Christians are the ones who have this much knowledge compared to this much knowledge that the older Christian has. It gets back to the point that we made at the very outset. People don't care how much you know. But the baby Christian is enthusiastic. Their life has been transformed. They're zealous, and they know what's happened in their life. They know what they were, where they've come from, and they just can't wait to share with all of their friends. Whereas those of us that have been in the church for a long time, we've gotten pretty content. And we're not as passionate as we once were. And, you know, maybe I would hope that just saying that kind of shocks us. You know, there's no reason that this church couldn't double in size in the last year, in the next year, if every single one of us really claimed that what it is that helped get us into the church is going to be what helps our church to grow again and that we become more effective. Number four, the best evangelism takes place in the context of mutual trust and respect. It takes place between friends. We are credible. It takes place between friends. Number six, this evangelism, oh no, number five, effective evangelism is usually best begun without a film, chart, or a Bible in hand because we meet people where they are, not where we are. Number six, am I going too fast? Are you with me? Number six, this evangelism can be carried in large or small churches without cumbersome program. So if you're a church of 700, 800, you can do friendship evangelism. If you're a church of 30, just getting started, you can do friendship evangelism. It doesn't require a big program. It doesn't require an extra meeting. What it does require is that individual Christians commit to sharing their faith. That's number six. It can be carried on in large or small churches without cumbersome programs. This evangelism can be carried on in large or small churches with only small monetary investment. But there must be an abundance of love. There's got to be an overflow of love. Love overflowing. Serious about what Jesus said as the mark of the church, John 13. By this will all men know that you are my disciples, that you have love one for another. Number eight. This friendship evangelism encourages chain reaction growth that gets back to the new Christians being the most effective ones, because when Karen is converted, she reaches out to her husband and he's converted. And then when Karen is converted and her husband is converted, Karen reaches out to her sister. And then her sister and her mother, or her sister and Karen, reach out and convert their mother. Chain reaction growth is what happens when you practice friendship evangelism. I'm saying number nine, no one method of evangelism should be used to the exclusion of all the others. I'm saying if you have an approach that's working, by God's grace, if it's scriptural, keep doing it. Don't just shut off all the others. Keep doing those, but add friendship evangelism. Number 10, each Christian has a God-given responsibility to build Christ's church numerically here on the earth. I did not say every one of us has to be teachers. In fact, James says, let not many of you be teachers, because teachers will receive the greater condemnation. But I did say that we all have the responsibility to be a part of the process. Maybe you're not the teacher. Maybe you're fixing the snacks for the Bible study that's going on. Maybe you're not the teacher. Maybe you're not preparing the snacks. But you open up your home, and so the Bible study takes place in your home. But we all have a responsibility to help Christ Church grow numerically. Number 11, we must learn to maximize our efforts on those most likely to respond. We don't shotgun the message out there, but we target the message to those who are most likely to respond. We'll talk about how you know about who those people are a bit later. By the way, one of the telltale signs, if they visited our church, they're looking for something. So we must learn to maximize our efforts on those most likely to respond. And number 12, finally, we must learn to serve those in need, both Christian and non-Christian alike. So much for a Bible class with a lot of you talking. You didn't get to talk much. I'm sorry. Thank you for listening. I hope this has been challenging, and I pray that it's been convicting. We'll be dismissed and start again at 10:30. Thank you.